I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I am your host, Kim Kessler, with the Resnick Program for Food Law and Policy at UCLA School of Law. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we are going to be talking first about a big piece of news this week in the food policy world, the move by six major urban school districts to source chickens that have been raised without antibiotics. The six school districts are working together through a new consortium, the Urban School Food Alliance, and these districts have a huge impact on the world of school nutrition as they collectively feed almost 3 million students a day. Joining me today to talk about this is Deputy Food Services Director of the Los Angeles Unified School District, Laura Benavides, and Mark Eisman, the Director and Senior Attorney of the Food and Agriculture for the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. They've both been very involved in shaping this initiative, and I want to thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So, Laura, I want to start with you and just hear from your perspective a little brief description of the initiative and what you forecast as its impact.
Well, we're looking at, as working through with LA Unified and the Alliance, of what we can continuously do to impact policy and the meals that we serve to our students. And chicken is one of the most popular items that we serve to students. And the impact for us moving forward with this working through our procurement process is to be able to provide better, healthy meals to our students.
And how did you come to make this one of your important procurement objectives? In other words, the identification of looking for antibiotic-free meat as one of your initial procurement objectives as a group?
Well, again, as you know, we talked about it as a group. As you know, how can we, I guess, best impact our student meals? And we really did focus on one of the items that we're currently serving. You know, it is the most popular. So we're looking at as that item as a opportunity to, and we knew that it was just an opportunity to be able to improve the meals that we're serving to our students.
So, Mark, can you describe NRDC's role in assisting the Alliance with this and, from your perspective, what the significance is of antibiotic-free meat for kids?
Well, as some of your listeners know, NRDC is a leading environmental and public health group that, for the last four decades, has worked on agriculture issues and, in the recent years, much more on food issues as it relates to your plate. And we saw an incredible opportunity when we started meeting initially with New York City school officials, which serve 860,000 meals a day, which is second only to the Department of Defense. It's an amazing statistic. And L.A. is just behind New York. So we saw the power of the purse here. We've seen it in the past when government has made the decision to buy recycled paper or buy green building products, it can really transform the national market. So we saw an opportunity. Their interest in buying antibiotic chicken dovetailed nicely with an NRDC campaign to raise awareness over this growing public health crisis, which the Centers for Disease Control has called one of the biggest health problems facing the country.
Can you give any sense of how, I think people are familiar with this issue that they may have their eyes out for meat that's been raised without antibiotic or chicken in this case, but can you give a sense of what the actual market looks like and how this can play a role in shifting it? I mean, how widely available is antibiotic-free meat, and what might this do for suppliers in terms of making that change?
Well, our understanding is that from both conversations that NRDC has had and that the schools themselves have had with chicken producers is that this product is available, and the goal is by sending this market signal, by saying we're going to buy this amount of chicken together, that will allow those producers to ramp up. Right now, production probably is not at the levels to accommodate everyone if everyone was asking if it was going to be starting tomorrow. But what's nice about this program is that it's going to be rolled in as contracts in each of the six cities expire, and they rebid and essentially asking producers to bid for their chicken contracts. And everything that we've heard, the industry will be able to meet the standard and provide that amount of chicken.
Laura, can you share for our listeners what it's been like to work with the Urban School Food Alliance and what things that you've seen that you all are facing collectively in terms of the challenges of meeting those goals that you talked about in the school food environment?
Well, it's been a great opportunity with Los Angeles to work with the Urban School Food Alliance, and knowing that we're representing, just like you had stated, almost 3 million students that we're feeding every single day. A lot of the different initiatives they're working on is to always, first and foremost, to always better improve the quality of the meals that we're serving, but also to improve the sustainability and the environment of the things that we offer to our students. A couple of the items that we're looking at is moving forward is to offer a compostable plate and utensils for our students that we were collectively working together to get onto one of our next steps.
And I know that this dovetails for L.A., and I'm sure a number of the districts, but for you, and L.A. in particular, with a lot of recent work and continuing work on improvement of your school food. Is there are there particular things that you can highlight to explain the kind of shifts that you've made and continue to make there in terms of both your policies and what you're actually serving?
Oh, absolutely. Just actually a couple of days ago, our school board unanimously passed our good food procurement for 2014, which actually is a stronger language on our procurement processes from our good food procurement that we passed in 2012, which really also highlights in reference to us procuring chicken products that are antibiotic-free, but also to be able to strengthen our processes with procurement of continuing to buy locally, to continually to look at the nutrition and offerings for our students, and also including animal welfare and a better and a stronger workforce for our of the companies that we're working with.
And as part of the work of the Alliance, I mean, I think hearing that it's the same kind of goals that people shopping at Whole Foods think of when they're thinking about what Whole Foods is doing to bring better food to the plate. I mean, how have you, in your career and through this work with the Alliance, thought about the reputation of school food and getting the message out about these efforts? And do you see the Alliance as something that helps you to do that?
Oh, absolutely, because, again, we're representing so many students nationwide. But for us, it's not necessarily, and I know, and not necessarily thinking about healthy food is a privilege. It is a standard, and we feel it's very important for all of our students, no matter from where they come from, that they deserve the best of what we get to offer them every single day.
And the actual specification in particular that you've announced here, one of the things that I noticed about it is that it calls for food that has never been, chicken that has never been fed antibiotics or treated with antibiotics. And that is a significant point. So, Mark, perhaps you can take us through and explain the difference between chicken that has been treated at therapeutic levels and chicken that has not been treated at all with antibiotics, and how the decision was made here to push for chicken that has never been treated with antibiotics.
Yeah, well, what the Alliance is saying is it wants to have chicken that has been raised without antibiotics. And for the listeners that may not know all of these details, and it's complicated. 80% of the antibiotics in this country are not used in hospitals and doctor's offices, but used to raise animals. And as a result of that, resistant bacteria, thank you, is spreading. And as a result, when you really need the antibiotics, they often don't work. So the Alliance is saying that's what we would like. And it is also saying if a company cannot do no antibiotics ever, then they have to submit a written plan explaining when the supplier will be able to meet that no antibiotics ever. And in the meantime, they need to meet a standard that only allows the use of antibiotics when the chickens are sick. What's happening now, you think of antibiotics as something you give humans or animals when they're sick. What's happening instead on a lot of these factory farms, and the conditions are so crowded and unsanitary that they're giving the antibiotics before they get sick or to keep them in crowded conditions. And so if the antibiotics are used only when they're sick, that's an interim standard that NRDC helped to put together with our partners, School Food Focus and the Pew Charitable Trust. And but again, the Alliance is asking ultimately that they want to move to no antibiotics ever.
And how will this actually roll out? So you talked about that this is going to be based on as different contracts expire for the different districts. Is there a district that's going first in terms of putting out a procurement request for this kind of chicken? And at what point will you know if you have successful respondents and if this initiative has come to fruition? Laura, maybe you can speak to that.
Sure. Well, LA Unified will be the first up. We are going to be doing our procurement processes starting in February, and showing off, you know, knowing that and we are going to be working with our procurement offices to ensure the company that receives the bid will be meeting the standards that we have set forward.
And have you had any responses from the vendors that you typically work with? Not responding to your bid, obviously, but responses in terms of the overall direction that you're moving in.
Not directly from LA. We in LA Unified has not received any response directly.
And I wanted to also ask about the second thing that you mentioned, the move for compostable trays. Is that something, what's the timeline for that, and how are you expecting that to roll out as well?
It's I apologize if I said tray. It was a compostable plate, which is a round
That was probably me, but
no, it's not
I'm
a
picturing
problem.
In New York City, I'm used to seeing trays.
Well, which is one of the reasons why we're wanting to be moving to a plate, because we want our children to have that experience of what they eat at home. Generally, in my home, we don't eat on a rectangle plate. We eat on a round plate. So it's something that we want our children to learn from that experience. We're finishing up working through with New York Public Schools about the finishing up the compostable plate bid, and we wanted to get that into our schools as soon as possible as well.
Can I just add on that, Kim?
Yeah.
That, I mean, getting rid of 270 million styrofoam plates a year in these six cities is great. I know LA has moved ahead on that front. So that's one benefit alone, just jettisoning the styrofoam. So also, by introducing compostable plates, we're able to address the food waste problem, where the food, extra food that's there that can't be reduced, it can be thrown in with the plate, and then that can be composted and put back on our farms, which is another benefit of this program.
Absolutely. I'm actually a parent of New York City school children, and our school is part of one of the New York City schools that is composting at lunch, and I have seen the heroic efforts to separate, which are largely successful, but it will be excellent for kids to be more easily able to sort their compostable waste. So I'm looking forward to seeing that come to fruition myself. So, Laura, you know, one thing I read about this announcement in the LA Times, and you talked about this a little bit on your call today, but you said having antibiotic-free chicken is not a privilege, it's a right, and you talked about that in general with your food. I mean, can you just expand upon where that comes from and how it ties into your work in general in school food?
Sure, of course. Well, in here in Los Angeles, we have over 80% of our children that qualify for a free or reduced price meal. Already some of the things that, you know, in reference to this particular procurement, it's an opportunity to share with our families that we want to make a difference in their students' lives. We are challenging all of our suppliers to know that what we are serving our kids is going to be, we want it to be the best. And it, whether it's antibiotic-free chicken or if it's, white milk, non-fat-free milk, it's something that we want to make sure that we are sharing with our parents, that we take seriously the health of their students. And we have the opportunity by that in Los Angeles and with the Urban School Food Alliance, because, again, we represent, serving 3 million students a day.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I want to thank you both for, first, your work on this incredible initiative and Step Forward, but also for joining us here today to talk about that. It's Mark Eisman of NRDC and Laura Benavides of the Los Angeles Unified School District. Thanks again. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with the second segment of the show.
Thanks,
Kim. Thank you.
You are listening to The Hustle by Alan Wilkes.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back on Eating Matters here on Heritage Radio Network, and I am now joined by Dennis Simic, who is National Geographic Executive Editor for the Environment. Dennis is here with me today to talk about the year in food as we come to the close of 2014. He conceived of the Future of Food series that Nat Geo has been featuring this year, and he has spearheaded the 8-month the 8 months of coverage focusing on how to feed our growing planet. Dennis, I want to welcome you to Eating Matters and to Heritage Radio Network.
How are you, Kim? Thanks for having me today.
Great to have you joining us. So I first wanted to just hear from you. For people who aren't familiar, I feel like people who are concerned about food and interested in food issues will definitely have seen or encountered some of the coverage that National Geographic has been doing this year. But if you can just give some background on what the work has been and what the series would look like, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So it was really conceived as a sequel and a conversation with our readers and our members about a series of large global sustainability issues. And, you know, really we started about a decade ago looking at climate change, and we did a special issue on global freshwater in 2010 and a series on population across 2011. And I was saying, well, but these are all connected, and given that what we're seeing with the climate at all, that maybe the next step in this conversation is really what's for lunch, what's for dinner. And so that began conversations where we started thinking about, well, how could we do this in a way that didn't overwhelm readers? So we broke it out into about eight different stories that started in May and started asking questions. How are we going to deal with the issue of feeding 9 billion? And then we broke it out into asking that question. And we brought in John Foley from the University of Minnesota, who was there at that time, who'd written a paper in Nature about how to sort of break this challenge out into several sections. And then we looked at aquaculture. We looked at this idea of land grabs or agricultural development in Africa. We looked at hunger in America. We looked at the history and the evolution of diet. We were trying to sort of frame something so that it wasn't just about the issues, but, you know, with agriculture, culture is the second half of the word, so we were trying to get at cultural dimensions. We looked at the evolution of diet and what we can learn from that for today. We actually did look at the role of improved genetics and biotechnology in crops, and what benefits will accrue to the crops and the farmers who grow them. We looked at the role of meat in our diets, and then a piece that came out in the December issue
right.
was on the joy of food.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you talk about the culture piece in agriculture, that brings us right to today and your current issue with that great cover line, the joy of food, which is,
right.
is something you just can't separate from these other pieces that have to do with the challenges and the scientific issues around moving forward. But I want to ask you, after having this year of being so steeped in these issues, you know, do you have some major impressions of 2014 in terms of some of the things that have happened in the world of food policy?
Food policy, I have to admit to you that, you know, I don't think that our audience is really one that's focused on the idea of food policy. I think our major goal really was, as one who has been involved in this for a long time, it is that food and where it comes from just doesn't register in the public mind. And trying to just get a connection between people in society and where food comes from and what it takes to make it happen and the magnitude of the enterprise and the impacts of it, I think it's like essentially, in one sense, that's the underpinning of what you need if you're looking to change policy. And so we're really in this role of explanatory education, trying to reconnect essentially a society back to the very basic thing that keeps them going. And that until World War II or so, there were a lot of people who were directly connected to agriculture, whether they grew up on a farm or they knew somebody who grew up on a farm. And so the last 60 years, we've seen a huge urban-suburban migration and a disconnection from those very basic things that we eat. And so, in one sense, we were just trying to make a reconnection.
Yeah, and that visibility piece, or, you know, as it's often referred to, the invisibility of food and food production does really affect how we talk about policy and think about policy, because some of these issues seem so abstract and removed from the ability to go to the grocery store and see food looking highly available, and even food waste being something that you know, I think until quite recently, I would say even in the last year or 18 months, has just not been at the forefront of a lot of people's thinking. And that's an issue, actually, that I know that you've looked at and talked about as part
right.
of this series. You know, what has been some of the responses you've gotten to your coverage of food waste and
well, certainly, I think that what we're trying to do, remember that there are two kinds of food waste, and there's the food waste that happens in this country when we're seeing, what is it, nearly half of the food that we have available we pitch. But there's another kind when we're also trying to talk about the global challenge, and that's it also, it's food loss, and we're trying to get at that idea too, and we will be getting at that actually next year in a story in the magazine. But I think that there this whole idea of waste, when you start thinking about this desire that the only fruits and vegetables that we will accept are the perfect ones, yet there are ones that are perfectly ugly, but they're perfectly wonderful as far as taste and edibility, or this whole issue of the eat by expire date thing, is that really true? And getting people to rethink that and to think about that, because it's like the idea that, like, oh, well, unless I eat it by this date, then I better pitch it. I'm sorry, I have yogurt in my refrigerator that's been out of date for more than a month, and I'll eat it, and I'm talking to you today.
Right. I grew up in a household where that philosophy was very much embraced, for better or worse, to
ignore
the expiration dates, but it's not that common.
Right.
And you know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was the topic of climate change and food and the interrelationship
right.
between them. To me, I think that has been something that's really come to the fore in the past year, and with the IPCC report making that link, and the People's Climate March here in New York City, where food groups had such a significant presence, that there's really been a turning point in understanding those connections. You know, what did your coverage?
Well, I would say that it may be with part of the society, but one thing I noticed, and I have been involved in speaking to a variety of groups who are involved in agriculture, and it may be that some parts of our culture are accepting of the climate science, but I did not necessarily see that actually in agriculture, that there still remains significant skepticism in agriculture about the human role in changing the climate. There is an awareness that the weather's changing, you know, seeing warmer winters, longer growing seasons, but this idea that somehow that humans are affecting it, I'm just saying that there is still a case that has to be closed if we're trying to, you know, get universal acceptance of this idea in the country. I mean, all you have to do is look at the division in our policymaking bodies. And I think
In the conversations that you've had, do you think that there is a need to have people accept that humans have a causal role, or that a focus on resiliency or adaption to weather changes, as you say, that some have acknowledged, can also build a bridge towards the necessary action steps?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a more productive approach. And for example, you can make the argument about human cause, or you can talk about risk management, and you can talk about reducing vulnerability. And I heard one farmer who was at a panel at a major conference talking about how he has to budget now for extreme weather. In the past, he would not have to take into account the need to replant because of heavy rain, but now he does. So there is an awareness that we're dealing with it. So then it really does, as you say, then it becomes, can we become more resilient by changing our cropping patterns? Can we become more resilient by looking at how we maintain land cover? How are we, you know, going about using the landscapes that we have?
And do you think that those steps would ultimately also have a mitigation effect on contributions to climate change, or the agriculture's contributions to climate change?
Well, so we do know that there's a heavy reliance on fossil fuels in agriculture. You know, face it, the trucks, the tractors, this synthetic nitrogen fertilizer that is actually, if you listen to like Vaclav Smil, the Canadian scientist who studied this, you know, upwards of 40% of the population of the planet is alive today because of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. So that's, you know, obviously the fossil fuels are heavily involved in it. But I think in a larger picture, there's a bigger issue that's affecting not just agriculture, but all of us, and it comes back to our larger societal reliance on coal, oil, and gas. And we did a big piece in April, it wasn't connected to the food series, partly because, you know, these are all connected issues anyway, but it was on coal. And as Dan Kamen, I heard Dan Kamen from Berkeley give a talk at the American Association for the Advancement of Science a couple of years ago, that since the year 2000, the increase in our reliance on coal as a power source, as a basic power source, has increased as much as our increase in reliance on all other energy sources combined, including renewables. And so until we can come to terms with how we're going to power how we're going to generate electricity, how are we going to turn wheels, agriculture itself is going to be affected just like the rest of us.
So you wrote a piece earlier this year about the role of agricultural research in taking some of these steps forward, and I wonder if you have reflections based on that research about the role of research in addressing some of these challenges related to climate change and resiliency.
Well, I think that we need to keep in mind that I think a point that I was trying to make was that, you know, there's private agricultural research and there's public. And the public agricultural research, for example, open source, publicly funded research is the kind of crop research that, say, Norman Borlaug and the crop researchers did when they came up with the hybrid crops 50 years ago. And so there's a kind of research that we are still in need of as a society when we're dealing with how are we going to create safe adaptive farming systems to a climate changed world. Those aren't necessarily the kinds of research investments that are going to work well with a corporation's bottom line. Yet, for the greater good, for the commons, they're absolutely necessary because we're seeing changes in weather patterns and changes in temperature, changes in precipitation, and not to mention the need for long-term commitment to research in crop varieties, because we can look forward and see that, oh, well, we're going to be living in a world of warmer temperatures overall, change precipitation patterns, and it's just not possible to turn around new crop varieties overnight that can respond to the changed growing seasons. And those aren't necessarily also the kinds of, that's not necessarily the kind of research that, once again, is going to be what makes a lot of money for a corporation. But at the same time, it's absolutely the kinds of things that can help build margins against downside risk in farming systems.
So I have to ask you, listening to you talk about all this, is there anything from your work over the past year on this series and now continuing, because I understand that National Geographic is going to continue, that makes you optimistic going forward as we look to 2015, going forward on how we can work together and make some of these needed changes around our food system?
Well, one thing I would say is that part of this, I think, is a generational challenge, and that yes, we can make changes, but it's also, I think, perhaps one of the most important things that we can do is that we can educate young people about this, because in time they filter up through the system, and they then become the researchers and the policymakers and the farmers and the people who are going to change the system. And I think when one looks at the policymaking system that exists currently, it's hard. There's an awareness of these kinds of things, but also there isn't the money that's coming. So part of this is not only a near-term challenge, but it's also a longer-term challenge. I have two kids in college now, and I think that it's trying to connect young people who are now trying to find their way in the world is just as important as anything that we might be doing in the near-term policy arena.
And a last question for you, after working on the series, has it impacted at all your own shopping and eating?
Oh, well, gee whiz, having worked on the series, you need to understand that I grew up on a farm in Oregon, and I studied agriculture in college and undergraduate and graduate, and I've been acutely aware of all this. I mean, you know, it's like, absolutely, you know, it's eating meat, be careful. There's only so much that's good for you, and that to try to buy local as much as you can to help farmers who are near you, and to don't waste food. Believe me, that's like one of the mantras in my house. So it's not like it's something that started and stopped with the series. In fact, I would say that much of all this actually informed what I was trying to do with the series. Having grown up on a farm in the Willamette Valley of Oregon and being connected to the land, that's actually was as much the impetus for wanting to do this as having
almost
done it.
Going in the other direction. So you don't have to be crying in the wind when you're telling people not to waste food.
No.
Coming over to your house or otherwise eating at your table.
You I'll just give
just
them
less. Hand them the latest copy of National
That's Geographic. Right. Here, as part of your dinner, I'll give you a nice bound copy of this. Right. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for joining. That's Dennis Dimmick of National
thank
Geographic,
you.
And they're continuing on with the Future Food series. We're glad to have you with us on Eating Matters today, and that will bring us to the close of Eating Matters on Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank all of our guests, and also a big thanks to my husband, Tim Archer, for our amazingly good show music. The show is available as a podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. I'm your host, Kim Kessler, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.